Christmas, let your heart be light. Next year all our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to True Stories from Tinseltown. And I've been gone for a bit, but I am coming back strong. I have a really great guest tonight. He was a guest before, John DeLeo. And welcome, John. Thank you.
Hey, Grace, it's good to be back with you. Thank you for having me.
I love having you. I had so much fun. And we just, your other book, which was amazing, I think we only got to 1940. And we went over an hour, you know? There was so much great stuff. Your 350 films, they were just amazing. But today we're going to talk about John's book, 100. Okay, I've got it right here. You guys, I'm sorry. I had laser eye surgery and I'm still blind as a freeing bat here. Oh, so
well, why don't I take it? I'll say it's 100 great film performances you should remember but probably don't. And it starts in 1920 and it covers the entire 20th century. The last performance is the year 2000.
Yeah, so I chose some that John chose, but I didn't choose any silence because I figure most of the people who listen to this podcast are more into, you know, the 30s, 40s, yeah. 50s. So it's
sure.
So I chose some, and I think we'll talk about them, but it's a really good book, and he made some incredible choices. If I don't talk about the other ones, it's just because we are going to try to... John has to go, and we're going to try not to do, you know, the Jerry Lewis telethon here. So, okay. So we'll start here, and I found some interesting facts here, but let's start with Edward G. Robinson and Five Star Final, 1931.
Yeah, it's fairly soon after he does Little Caesar, so he's suddenly a big movie star, and this is a sort of another, you know, juicy piece of material, you know, pre-code, really fast, ruthless newspaper drama, and it does have a kind of a dated, hokey side, but his scenes are not part of that. Everything he's in really holds up rather well. And I think, as in Little Caesar, you just see this exciting new personality of the talkies who is clearly meant to be there and is so genuine, so authentic, so exciting. And like I said, it's no wonder he became a major star, even though, you know, it's parts of it are kind of sort of a junky melodrama.
Well, you know what parts I think are the when you have Nancy Voorhees, she is a stage actress and she's over the top.
Yeah, it's the family scenes of that family he sort of ruins with the newspaper. You know, most of that early 30s work he does at Warner Brothers, all those fast melodramas, you know, he's so good in all of them, and he plays a variety of roles. And I probably could have picked, you know, something else, but something about that role and the sort of the intensity he brings to it just was the one I wanted to highlight.
I loved it. And also, you know, how he always washed his hands because he knew he was working in, you know, scummy, horrible stuff.
That was a nice touch. Yes.
I like that a lot. And you know what? I never knew this, but when I was reading this, you said not only did he never get an Academy Award, he was never nominated.
It's shocking.
It is. I cannot believe that. It's wonderful. He was such a great actor.
You would think for Little Caesar alone, just because it made him a name, that would be an automatic nomination. And you think of Key Largo or the Seawolf or Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet. And that's a good point about the book. Even though A few of the 100 performances in the book were nominated. Certainly none of them are winners. Primarily, it's a book about performances that were not nominated. Although, like I said, it's not really an Oscar book, but primarily they weren't nominated. And then there were a few that were, but clearly didn't win. And yet, you know, it's Robinson among the men and Myrna Loy among the women.
Another she was person, never nominated?
Never nominated. Those are the two giants of the Golden Age. One man, one woman, who you cannot believe, you know, in her case with The Thin Man or The Best Years of Our Lives, the two most obvious examples. But how is this possible that those two people got through so many decades, you know, into old age without getting something?
Now,
they both did get special ones way at the end. I believe his was posthumous and hers was almost. So it was kind of too little too late. But
it makes me mad. Yeah, you wrote that.
It makes me mad, was, too.
He died 2 months before he was to get the Lifetime Achievement Oscar.
Yeah.
And the last film he did was Soylent Green. And maybe that's not a fabulous film, but he was incredible in that film.
Yeah.
Saul. He was just wonderful, endearing. He was great. I mean, he was fabulous. And I was really stunned to read that. So that was a big piece of like, ooh la la to me.
Yeah.
Okay, so on to our next person. Let's talk about this one. I love this movie and I love this man. William Powell and Libeled Lady.
Yeah, William Powell, you know, one of the great light comedians of the 30s and 40s. So impeccable, so dapper, so flawless in his delivery. And you think, what would be an underrated William Powell movie? You know, obviously, you're not going to include The Thin Man or My Man Godfrey. But Libeled Lady, of course, was a big hit. And I think the reason I picked that for him is that you've got four great people in it.
Amazing.
Alongside Powell, of course, Myrna Loy and Gene Harlow and Spencer Tracy. And they're all kind of terrific in it. But for me, the sort of magic element of that, the particular comedy, is William Powell. And I think he's sort of, if there's one reason we love this movie, he's really the main reason, I think, that we love it. And so I thought that was a good one to highlight. And it is that, you know, 1936 is the golden year of William Powell because he's the star of the Best Picture winner, The Great Ziegfeld. He's nominated for an Oscar for My Man Godfrey. And then, Libeled Lady, too. So it was quite something. And the first sequel to The Thin Man, after The Thin Man. So imagine having all that going on in 1 year.
And I do agree. I think Libeled Lady was one of his best comedic performances, although he had so many. Love Crazy, I Love You Again. I mean, he's just amazing. And he also did drama. He was fabulous.
Say that. I've lost you.
he also did drama. And I'm saying that, you know.
Are you there?
You can't hear me? And he was such an amazing actor as a dramatic actor as well. He was just wonderful.
I love him in, speaking of drama, One Way Passage with Kay Francis, which is a movie I wrote about in my book Screensavers. That was one of the five love stories I highlight because it's just, to me, it's a perfect movie. You know, you have to love a good soap opera, but if you love that kind of soapy love story, it's just about a perfect, you know, a perfect example of that kind of movie.
And the acting between he and Kay were marvelous. Yeah. And the two of them had worked together. They had really good chemistry.
Yeah, they were a good team. They were, you know, pre-Myrna Loy. That was his best teammate.
Yeah. And that movie, did you ever see the remake?
Yes. And it's, you know, it's just not as good. They overcomplicate it and it just doesn't have it. I think it was really of its time. And even by 1940, it just was a little late for that particular story. I don't know. It doesn't seem hokey in 1932. It just seems perfect.
And it's a beautiful love story. And you know, the ending gives me goosebumps, but we're not going to talk about this. We don't spoil.
We've drifted across.
Yes, but he was wonderful. Libeled Lady, you guys. What I just got amazed at is that he did all of his own stunts in that fishing scene, which is amazing.
It's very good.
Yes. I know, he
very good physical comedy. Yeah,
he can do it all, and people don't get like. how hard comedy is to make somebody laugh. Comedy, like they say, drama, we all can do drama. You know, we all get the same thing, but comedy is hard.
Yeah, and that's that
dying,
thing.
What do they say? Dying is easy, comedy is hard. Yeah.
And able to do like the great sort of dry wit line delivery, which of course he was a master of, and then also, like I said, to be able to do slapstick in the water. Yeah, you're right. It's both sort of the full spectrum of comedy.
Yes, and he also was good, and when he had to be serious in there, he was, and he was just wonderful. And all of them, they were a great team. The four of them were amazing. I just thought they were great. Okay, so the next one I want to go to, this is not a movie I think a lot of people know. I've seen it a few times, and I like it very much, and I liked what you wrote about it. Humphrey Bogart and Black Legion, 1937.
Now, yeah, of course, you know, with a book like this, I wanted to include just about all of the major stars, so it wasn't sort of unknown performances by people you haven't heard of. So then it was sort of, you know, a mission to include the giants, like, you know, there has to be a Humphrey Bogart performance. And then you think, well, what is a Humphrey Bogart performance that everyone doesn't know? And if they don't know it, is it just one of those throwaway things he did really early? So what would that be? And I thought this was a perfect one because it's after The Petrified Forest. So everyone knows who he is now. And
Duke Manatee.
He's made a name. Yeah. And but it's before, you know, The Maltese Falcon and High Sierra, which makes him a real star. So it's that in-between period in which he mostly didn't get very good roles. I mean, he was more of a name. He's more prominent. But he's usually playing, you know, a supporting role to Cagney or George Raft or Betty Davis. But this was a really rare example of for him to get a really good part in a really good script. It's sort of a B movie. It's not a major Warner Brothers production of that year, but it's a really good story of a sort of regular guy who gets sort of sucked into the KKK. And then when he realizes what's happened, he can't get out.
It's too late.
And it's a really good performance. It just shows, you know, it's before any of the sort of, the things we associate with Humphrey Bogart. I mean, he's not a major star, so he's not, you know, he doesn't have sort of characteristics that the audience is expecting from him. He's just a sort of still a youngish actor trying to prove his worth, and he's really excellent.
He really is. And also, like you said in the book, you know, he's totally believable as a regular Joe, because when he sometimes says his lines, he says, "Dad, I will do," you know, I mean, but he was believable. And it's really, if you guys can catch this film, it's not around often. TCM doesn't play it much, but it is really worth it to catch Humphrey. And it's not really about, they're called the Black Legion, and they go after, I don't know, the Polish guys and people like that.
Yeah, it's a variation on the
KKK. They don't do the, so obviously we know what it is, but it is really an interesting film, and I agree with you 100% that Humphrey Bogart did a great job, and it's something you guys should see. Okay, another one we want to talk, Betty Davis and the Old Maid. This movie gets me mad. I don't know why. It just gets me mad for many reasons. But she did an amazing job, but gets me mad.
It probably gets you mad because as soap operas go, and of course this is that sort of golden age of, you know, the Hollywood soap, you know, so many of them do have that masochism element, and this one is certainly
to the Maximilian show.
right up there because of the things, you know, the wrong choices people make, and then the suffering that goes on. When you think maybe there are ways around this, but I always think it gives me a good cry. And I do love her performance because we watch her go from the sort of sweet, innocent young thing to an old woman.
But she's not. That's the thing that you said.
Well,
it's like 15 years later, she looks, 80 year olds don't look like she does. You know, she looks like this old biddy, and you know, she's not even 40.
Woman.
Right.
Right, right. An older woman who's sort of considered, yes, considered older. But again, we're talking 1939, Betty Davis, you know, the year of dark victory mm-hmm. and the private lives of Elizabeth and Essex. It's the year she wins the Oscar for the previous year's Jezebel. She is riding high, and this is just almost a throwaway because everything else she's doing is so great. She's really good in this, but it's not that well remembered because, like I said, it was like her greatest hits one after the other.
Right,
and something
exactly.
If somebody else did this, you'd notice it. But with Betty Davis, it was just, yeah, she's great in everything. Move on to the next thing, you know, and she just kept knocking them out. So I think this one has been lost in the shuffle, and it's not as good as Dark Victory. Same director, Edmund Goulding, same year, but it's still really good. And there are some really beautiful scenes in this movie. And, you know, she and Miriam Hopkins famously didn't like each other, but they have some, you know, they really work well together. And they have a really good showdown. Actually, they have a number of good showdowns, but they have one early on in the picture that I think is pretty strong. And I do recommend this when people, you know, you've seen now Voyager 100 times and All About Eve, and they're fantastic, of course. But this is sort of the one, like the next in line after you've seen all the
one
all
that got away. Try.
Yeah.
It.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what that gets me, though, is like towards the ending, Miriam was a beast. She had,
yeah.
She just basically ruined Betty's life in this film.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and like I said, masochism is the theme.
She did. And then at the end, you know, the doctor's saying, oh, now you have to live with her, the bitter old maid. And it's like, well, why was she a bitter old maid, Doc?
Yeah.
But it's really an interesting film.
Well, it's interesting because even though Miriam Hopkins has the better life, you know, she will always be jealous of Betty Davis because George Brent went to her, and she's sort of punishing her for the, you know.
Yes, of course. You know,
a lifelong punishment and sort of, yeah. Well, you know, you saw it.
Yes. Let's talk. Okay, another one is Vivian Leigh and Waterloo Bridge. And I have to say, what? I think this is my favorite Vivian Leigh movie. And I think she never looked more beautiful. And this was in 1940.
Yeah, she is astonishingly beautiful. And yes, it's the first thing she does after Gone with the Wind. So you would think that just about anything would be something of a letdown. And yet the role is really completely different in it. She's really nothing like Scarlett O'Hara. So it was actually smart, but she's got this defeatist quality, which is the opposite of Scarlett O'Hara. Nothing will defeat her. And there's a sadness in this girl
very
from the beginning
so.
Of the movie.
Very
and it's so. Unfortunately it plays out, but she has a kind of sort of negative outlook. But then she falls madly in love, and the scenes with Robert Taylor are quite lovely. And you know, again, this is again, there's certainly an element of masochism in her story, which goes horribly wrong. But there's something about the dignity and the beauty in what she does that I don't know. You never feel it never feels cheap and crummy.
No, you
I mean,
always.
I guess what I'm saying,
her.
She elevates.
She
elevates it, and because it's so fully dimensional, we actually believe something that would be an sort of an outlandish story if it happened to someone we knew. It's like that can't happen. But there's something so rich and beautiful in her work that it gives sort of dignity to the whole movie, which is really beautifully made too.
It is. I just love this movie. It is.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, I know tons of people love this movie, I have to say, go get it or watch it if it comes up, because it does play on TCM. And she is amazing. She looks amazingly beautiful, and she just gives a subtle. See, Scarlett's so over the top. This is such a beautiful, subtle, real performance, and. I agree with you. It is one that, you know, you guys should see and remember. It's amazing. Okay, so we're going to go from her to our little impish Cary Grant in Suspicion.
Yes. This was, you know, of course, Cary Grant has to be in a book like this. And I thought, you know, Suspicion, he was always very criticized for the work in Suspicion because of, you know, the whole did he or didn't he kind of thing that carries through. He has to keep us guessing, does he want to murder her or not?
You know?
Are her suspicions justified? Yes. They had the two different endings. Like, does the actor even know what to play? Because they don't even, when are they going to solve the ending and decide what the truth is?
Yes.
And will they go back and forth in the cutting room? And, you know, so, I mean, it's got a lot of problems built into usually anytime you're playing a role in which the audience has to keep guessing and you have to tilt it both ways so that the guessing can be sustained for 90 minutes to 2 hours. The reason I wanted to include it is, well, I thought he was really wonderful at keeping us guessing. He is very seductive. He is very intriguing and, But primarily, you know, Joan Fontaine won the Oscar for this movie, and she's always gotten the credit. Yeah. But I always thought the magic, okay, I go back to that, what is the magic element? And it's that seductive, subtle, as you mentioned about Vivian Leigh, there's a subtlety here of drawing us in and keeping us guessing, and the vulnerability of that this guy, nothing seems to work out for this guy, and he's always sort of insecure about his manhood. And I always thought her performance was really rather dull.
Me too.
And even though I thought she's great in Rebecca, I love her.
Me too.
In that.
And that's why they thought she got the Oscar.
Yeah,
because
I think she basically, her performance in this is very uninteresting.
I agree.
And the reason that the movie, the reason that she was helped to an Academy Award is basically all the heavy lifting he's doing, where she just sort of reacts, not always very interestingly, and usually rather repetitively. We get sort of tired of that look on her face.
Yes.
I do.
I do too. I agree.
But he gives it a charge, a sexual charge and a humorous charge, and, you know, all the Cary Grant charm, but showing sort of the dark side of that, which probably the best example of that from him, of showing that sort of dark nature. Hitchcock was good at bringing out of people.
He was amazing at bringing that stuff out.
Yeah,
because especially, you really don't see it because he sort of like foofs it off, but you really see it when Beaky tells, you know, well, your wife is saying blah, 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 and then he kind of gives her that really cold, she's never seen that side of him before.
Yeah.
Cold kind of thing. And I think all the characters were much more interesting than Lena. I mean, you know, you have the writer, you have Beaky, you have all these people, even Ethel.
Yes. She's adorable,
yes. Yeah, but he did a good job. I was disappointed, of course, with the ending. I wanted it to be I thought it was stupid, the ending, but he did a great job. I agree with you on that. Okay, so moving right along, let's go to this. I really like that you chose him, Joel McRae in Sullivan's Travels.
Well, I'm sure I mentioned, maybe I didn't mention it last time we talked, because I've written a lot about Joel McRae, but he didn't really come up too much in 10 movies at a time because I'd written so much about him in previous books.
No,
but he's my favorite. He's my favorite Golden Age movie actor.
Really?
I'm not saying he's the greatest, but he's my favorite. So I just love him.
I love him,
and
too.
Of course, I love Sullivan's Travels because that's one of my favorite movies. And I think the reason I included that in this book, even though some might say, isn't that a little famous for this book? But Joel McRae still isn't famous enough beyond, you know, the hardcore movie buffs. And I thought any opportunity to toot his horn, you know, I'm
toot,
on
toot,
board.
Toot, toot. Me too. I love him.
Exactly. I love his work in comedy and westerns and dramas. He never disappoints me. He's very ahead of his time because he's so natural, so economical. When you see an old Joel McRae performance, it's not like, it's the 30s.
No,
you know,
not at all.
It looks like he did it yesterday.
Look at Palm Beach. Story. Did you ever see this one? Oh my God. Silver Something. That's where he met Francis D. And it's about a mother's love.
Oh, the Silver
love.
Cord.
Oh
yeah,
my Lord.
Cord.
Did you see it? Oh,
Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to do a podcast on mother love. And that one's coming up, man. That was, I just saw that. That's like a oof.
Yes.
But Sullivan's Travel, you know what? And I have a page on Facebook and I post stuff and I post, you know, there's certain people that get a lot of, and I love Joel McRae and I've posted the Palm Beach Story, certain things, and he just doesn't get it. I don't get it. You know, he just doesn't get that.
Well, it was just that he, you know, never was one of those actors who on screen never draws undue attention to himself. He just does what he's supposed to do. He draws you to him.
Right.
But he's not trying to sort of, I think that's why so often the women in his movies are so great, because they love working. You can see they love working with someone who's so giving and sort of selfless on the screen. And he's usually doing whatever he can to make them look good, which in the process makes him look good, because he's so, you know, irresistible at being so you know, unselfish on the screen.
So I don't know why usually, people don't get that, you know.
I don't know. Well, he just he's another one who was never nominated for an Oscar, but and you would think certainly for something like Ride the High Country later, where he's, you know, fantastic in it, but again, he's so good it's sort of easy to overlook
he seems
the mastery
so natural
of what he's doing.
But in that one it's great. He plays a director and he just wants to travel because he's sick of doing comedies. He thinks he's doing, you know, like,
he wants to go out in the world and learn about suffering so he can come back and make his sort of Grapes of Wrath kind of movie.
Right.
And, you know, he's such a good comic actor. And then, of course, that takes a great sort of turn into drama.
Right.
And again, he's the perfect actor to pull that off.
Yeah. And he was wonderful. And I love this performance. I love this film. Yeah. And it's moving. It's funny. But he is, of course, the guy that holds it all together. And he's not some flashy guy. He's not out there like, you know, Mr. Movie Star. He married Frances D. He's not out there like, you know, Mr. Mogambo or going to the Brown. You know what? He wasn't that kind of a guy.
Yeah.
And but boy, what a good movie. And he was amazing. I totally, totally agree with you.
I'm glad.
I love him. I love him. I'm not a Western person, but he was in so many Precoats. He was in so many great films. I love Palm Beach Story as well.
I do too.
I mean, he's adorable. He's like just. Boy, I'd love to have
met him and married him. I write about a long piece about the Palm Beach Story in my book Screensavers 2, the sequel, because there's a lot of Joel in that book, and that's one of the ones that gets a long piece, because I like you, I love that movie, so yeah.
It's wonderful, and I love Claudette Colbert. She's one of my favorite actresses
as
well.
She's
amazing. Okay, so the next one we'll talk about is Anne Sheridan in King's Row. And I love Anne Sheridan, period.
Yeah, and I love Anne Sheridan, too. She had a great speaking voice. She's beautiful. She's sexy. She's, you know, a good sort of hard-boiled sort of smart aleck where you love her because she seems to be the smartest person in the room. But, you know, because she was so beautiful, she didn't get a lot of acting chops. She had a lot of good wisecracking roles, like in They Drive by Night. But in, you know, King's Row, it's a period piece. It's a very serious drama. And she doesn't come into it for the first hour. And then she kind of dominates it emotionally. You know, even though Ronald Reagan and Robert Cummings have the leads, to me, she's the heart of that film.
She is the heart, exactly.
She does not make a false move. It's such a beautiful performance. And I wish Warner Brothers had come up with some better roles after it, after she'd proven herself. But there's a couple of, I like her in The Unfaithful, which, you know, 5 years later. But
mostly,
Mostly they didn't give her good stuff. And I'm so glad that movie exists, King's Row, because it's got a lot to recommend, actually. It's got that great Korngold score. It's got Claude Rains.
I adore.
Betty Field. Yeah, it's got a great cast.
Betty
and it's
Fields.
Beautifully, it's James Wong Howe photographed it. I mean, it's a beautiful, you know, top of the line production. And like I said, it's got a lot of juice. It's a real Peyton Place before Peyton Place.
Well, but they didn't the book was even juicier, and they had to cut it down.
But you know, she really is, as I said, the heart and soul of the story, and gives it a depth that might not be there without her.
Also, you know, I thought Ronald Reagan did a great job.
He is. He did. It's certainly, I would say it's his best performance.
I agree.
As well. Because he gets, you know, we expect that he'd be good in the sort of the first half of the cockiness.
But, yes.
You know, he too is rather touching in the second half.
Yes.
When things start to, you know, obviously become much more serious. And yeah, he does meet the challenge.
What a movie, you guys. If you haven't seen King's Row, you should. And she is wonderful. You fall in love with her.
Yes.
You know, the weak spot to me in any movie is Robert Cummings. I just don't like this guy.
He's not, he's really not very good in this. I mean, he's good enough to just sort of, you know, move it along, but there are a couple of sort of moments where you roll your eyes and think, I wish somebody else had been in this, because he's a little too golly gee whiz.
Yes, and he's not leading man material.
No, and you don't really believe he's someone who would go to Vienna to become a psychiatrist.
No, he's the unbelievable.
He's fine. He's fine in like comedies, but this, I think, there must have been someone better who was around. To play this.
But it's still a good movie. It's still worth a watch.
It's still a very good movie.
They have amazing actors and actresses in this, and Anne Sheridan really is the heart of it. And I totally agree with you. Now, this is another movie. I'm going to go to this one that I don't think a lot of people have seen or heard about. I never heard about it until I was like sort of, eh. But I saw it was like 4 stars. It was on TCM, Ronald Colman in The Talk of the Town. Totally agree. What a great, great performance.
Yeah. And it's like Libeled Lady. It's one of those, you know, star heavy movies. And you think, well, if you're going to write about this one, who would you write about? Because it's Ronald Colman, but it's also Cary Grant and Jean Arthur. And they're all terrific in it.
Oh.
And I remember when I sat down to write this piece, for this book, I was intending, because I already loved the movie from, you know, previous viewings, intending to write about Jean Arthur. And as I was watching it, I think I got about halfway through taking notes on her, and it kind of clicked with me. Wait a minute. The reason this movie is so good, and the reason we love it, for those of us who do, is Ronald Colman, because
100%.
That's the character who changes the most.
Yes.
It all hinges on what's happening with him.
Yes.
And they're sort of reacting, but he goes through the whole, you know, like I said, this metamorphosis, and we're so engaged by watching him loosen up. And sort of change his outlook. And it's incredibly charming. And again,
I fell madly in love with him in this movie.
Again, like a William Powell, you know, an incredibly dapper, witty, light comedian. And he's great with Cary Grant. He's great in the scenes with Jean Arthur. And this was, you know, nominated for Best Picture. It was a big hit at the time, but it kind of, talk about falling by the wayside, because the next year is, you know, George Stevens again directed Jean Arthur in The More the Merrier with Joel McRae, which I love. It's in the book for Jean Arthur. But, and that one sort of stayed famous in a way that this one kind of, like I said, fell away. And I saw it in a revival house in New York, probably sometime in the late 80s or early 90s. And I knew of it, but I don't recall it having been on television. I guess it was before TCM.
Right.
And I just loved it. And I still love it. So.
I love it. And, you know, Carrie's an anarchist. And Jean sort of has the choice between the two. And at the end, I wanted her with Ron. Well, I'm spoiling. Let's just say
I was going to say, what's good about it, that's a triangle in which you really don't know, and even in the last scene, who she's going to end up with. And usually, in most movies with a triangle, you know in the first scene who's going to end up, you know, where. And so it does sustain that, and she has such good connections with both of them that you know, you could think. And there's also that sort of very kind of homoerotic connection between the guys.
Right.
So you think it could go one of three ways when you're watching it now, because their bond, actually the bond he has with Cary Grant is actually more life-changing for him than the one he has with her. And so you could make that case. So
we could. It's a good movie, you guys. And Ronald Colman, Carey, and Jean Arthur are fabulous in it. It's a talk of the town. And I fell in love. Well, I love Ronald Colman anyway, but I loved him in this movie. And now, this is one of my favorite movies and one of my favorite performances. Joseph Cotten in Shadow of a Doubt.
Yeah, this is one, again, Hitchcock tapping into someone's dark side. But you think, how was this performance not nominated for an Oscar? I mean, I think it's Joseph Cotten's greatest performance. But it's also one of the great serial killer performances in movie history.
I agree.
The depth, the complexity, the charm, the darkness, the very interesting bond he has with his niece,
beautifully kind of creepy.
By Teresa Wright.
Yes,
it's got so much, and people love it and have loved it ever since. Reportedly, it was Hitchcock's favorite movie of his own work.
Allegedly, yes.
And you think, how was this performance not nominated for an Oscar? Because Cotten was great in so many things. Like Joel McRae, someone who made it look easy, was often taken for granted.
I agree 100%.
And he was never nominated for an Oscar ever, so put him on that list as well.
He did so much great work. And this one especially.
Yeah, this was the triumph of his movie career, and it came fairly early. You know, he was still fairly new to movies. Magnificent work.
And it really was kind of ahead of its time in certain respects, because if you remember, they were talking about, you know, in that thing with the sister and Teresa Wright, and they were talking about how Charlie got a bike, he rode it out in the ice, and he had a head injury, and they didn't know if he would live.
Yeah.
And how he changed after that head injury.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like Jekyll and Hyde. You remember, you know, in the beginning, the guy got a head injury and he became like Drain. But even today, they're studying the brains of serial killers. And a lot had some sort of brain trauma, which is amazing. A lot didn't, but many did. So that was ahead of its time. But
that is interesting. Well, it's also interesting because, for a movie made during World War II, where you have this threat in this perfect American town, but it's not
wonderful.
A Nazi. You know, it's not a spy. It's not a saboteur. It's an American. I mean, it's one of us. And so I guess you could take it as a metaphor for the Nazis or some kind of evil infiltration. But that is not actually the case. It is just someone in your family, basically. So it's the horror.
Yes.
I mean, it is very scary. Your perfect town, it's a place that seems so shielded from anything like what happens.
Right.
And I think that's the essence of its effectiveness.
And that's why Hitch thought it was so scary. It's because you're in this perfect little town. You have this lovely little family, and in comes a monster in them. Oh my God, some of his speeches. Are they fat, wheezing animals? I mean, those things, amazing. So if you guys have not seen it, I am going to tell you, see it. And Joseph Cotten is amazing. And he should have been nominated, and he should have won.
Probably,
for this
yes.
role, because he was just amazing. Okay, so now let's go to Dorothy McGuire in The Spiral Staircase. I thought she was great. I love that movie. Love it.
Yeah, it's a really good. It's not Hitchcock, but it's good enough that it could be Hitchcock. It's Robert C. Udmack, but it's so beautifully done in that sort of Hitchcockian way. With it, it's so smart and so clever and so inventive. It's interesting because she's playing. She's deaf and she's mute, and the performance operates like a silent film. And it's interesting. It could be like a Lillian Gish performance.
Right.
She does everything with her eyes, and you know, and of course she's eventually terrorized by the film's maniac. But she's able to do so much within the restrictions of the role. And, you know, we feel so much for her. We're so sympathetic to every move, and we're terrified for her because we think nothing must happen to this girl. You know, she too was riding high with she'd done Claudia and the Enchanted Cottage and was about to do Gentleman's Agreement. Of course, Tree Grows in Brooklyn. So this was another sort of example for Dorothy McGuire to show her versatility, and it's a period piece, and she really, really is impressive. Like I said, it's a showy role because you get to do a lot of stuff.
But no talk. She's amazing.
Yeah. And she's very impressive and very, you know, subtle, or we would laugh. You know, she's really draws you in, and we're watching every move. So she doesn't have to do too much to get our attention because she's got it from the minute the movie starts.
I thought Ethel Barrymore was also great. Amazing in this. Did you know? I mean, I thought it was funny because they just show us an eyeball of the maniac murderer.
Yes.
Did you know who the maniac murderer was?
Well, you know, it's funny. The first time I ever saw this, I was so young, I don't remember. Because then every time I saw it again, I always remembered who the killer was. So I can't actually answer that question.
Yeah. I knew who the maniac eyeball was.
Based on the eyeball?
I recognized it. Yes. But I still love the movie, and I thought it was fabulous. And if you guys can catch this, Dorothy McGuire was great. It scares me. It's like a scary...
Well, the other thing in terms of the eyeball, this is one of those thrillers. There aren't that many suspects, so there's that too. You know, it can only be a few people because it's a rather small cast. So there's that too. Yeah.
And then the obvious choice, you know, so you always have to think about, okay, here's the obvious choice. So, you know, the obvious choice is not the eyeball person, but I'm not talking about who it is. I'm just not saying. All right.
Stop talking about, you know, we don't want to give it away.
No. I used to do spoilers, but I don't do them anymore. I'm like, I've learned my lesson. Okay.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Let's do Linda Darnell in A Letter to Three Wives. Love, love, love that movie.
Yeah.
And she and
Paul Douglas
are my favorites. That is like the story to me. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's why it's last, because it's certainly the best. Although the middle one is very good too. Only the first one, the Jean Crane one, I think is sort of weak compared to the other two.
Yeah, it's sort of a Snoresville,
I guess it's a good way to start it. But you know, this is a very famous movie, and I probably wouldn't have included it in the book, except Linda Darnell, like Anne Sheridan, is just someone people don't even think of as an actress. They just think of her as one of the most beautiful women in movies of the 1940s. And they're right, she was. But when she got opportunities, she could be so good. And of course, probably this is the performance of her life.
Oh, I agree.
And again, it's as a wisecracking comic performance, this is as good as anybody's. And then again, there's the depth. There's that. It's a great love story.
You see her vulnerability.
Absolutely.
Big time.
You've got two people. It's an interesting love story with her and Paul Douglas, because it's the rare love story in which the two people are deeply in love with each other, but neither one is brave enough to admit that. And so they're sort of living as if it's a marriage of convenience, when they're actually madly in love with each other, but no one wants to be the one to be rejected if they admit that. And so it's kind of a wonderful, really kind of unique love story. And of course it's comic.
And
both terrific. And the chemistry, and you think, who would put Linda Darnell with Paul Douglas?
Amazing chemistry.
Sort of character man. And they are magic together. And she is every bit as gifted in this movie as she is beautiful. And
yes,
she is beautiful.
She is beautiful. And I totally get that, because she and Paul Douglas were my favorite. And I thought she did an amazing job. And what you like, she had the most tragic ending.
I love, you know, I really love Linda Darnell, and I like her in so many movies. And you think she was essential. Her career was kind of over. I mean, she was in stuff, but it's really over by the age of 30. And then she's dead at the age of 41, and it's a fire. I mean,
it was awful. And she was watching a film that she was in. Well, she started at like 15, right? Wasn't she Virgin Mary in Song of Bernadette?
Right. Yeah, she was a star while she was still a teenager, and so it seemed like she had a longer career than she had because it started so she was so young. But you know, by the time the 50s come, you know, she's got a good role in No Way Out, but pretty much after that, there really isn't much to talk about.
No,
and it's a shame because again, people like Darnell or Ann Sheridan or Veronica Lake, they had enough opportunities to prove they were more than just pretty faces.
Right.
And ultimately, they were still victims of the ageism of, well, now you're 35 and no one cares.
Unbelievable, right?
Awful, awful.
So, yeah. So did you ever, this isn't in the book, but I just want to say, Pinky. Have you ever seen that film?
Yeah, I like Pinky very much. I think it's a really good movie, even though I wish it weren't Jean Crane.
I wish it was Linda Darnell. That's why I bring it up. She would have been believable.
She would have been believable, yes. There were a couple of people who would have been better, you know, maybe Jennifer Jones or right. even Ann Baxter. They would have been more believable. And I think Kazan did a great job in his filmmaking in creating that world, that sort of decaying southern town. And there's some wonderful performances. You know, Ethel Barrymore, again, is great in that. But Jean Crane is the thing you wish you could change. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but yeah, I just, for some reason, I always thought that she would be wonderful in that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Okay, let's talk, and I love him, Robert Mitchum in The Night of the Hunter.
Yes. Well, Mitchum, you know, another, like McRae, I mean, I guess made it look easy, was so modest in terms of never acting like he was a great actor or never, in interviews, always being very self-effacing, very, oh, please, I just learned my lines.
And also drunky poo, so that helped.
Yeah. So while he was doing all that, you know, publicly, he was giving so many great performances and showing a range that I think people forget. The range of roles Robert Mitchum played, to think of him as a certain kind of tough guy. And you think like a Night of the Hunter as a, you know, psycho killer, or the Marine in Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, or the sheep drover in The Sundowners, or the guy in Out of the Past, the noir, the captain in G.I. Joe. It goes on and on and on. He gave at least 10, you know, incredible movie performances will live on. And he only got one nomination for G.I. Joe, but again, it was easy at the time, not that I was there in the 40s and the 50s, but it was easy to overlook him as just, you know, movie star, yeah, capable. And I think people, as time was going by, they weren't noticing just how good he really was. And he wasn't doing anything to dissuade them of that, you know, notion.
No, because he, you know, he was very modest or whatever, but he was great in that film. And and I just love the whole thing. It's you know, the cinematography.
Yeah.
Lillian Gish. I mean, I just love the whole look of this movie. And this is a really great flick. And to check it out, if you want to see a good movie, Charles Laughton, wasn't this his only thing he directed?
Yeah, only movie as a director, and because it flopped at the box office and sort of critically as well. He never did it again. It's a shame because he made a masterpiece
out. It was incredible.
But, you know, for Mitchum, you know, I don't buy his poo-pooing himself as not really much of an actor. When you look at the way he threw himself into this role, the risks he takes, the outrageous things he does that only someone really talented could pull off.
Right.
You know,
and to be so evil and hated.
Yeah.
Or look at him in, what's the one, with Gregory Peck?
Cape Fear, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean, he plays just a total, like, creepy, evil Scuzz. Yes. But I love him. I just do. And I love his interviews. I watch him on YouTube, on DeCavitt, and all those things. And I just
he is one of my favorites, too. Absolutely.
Fabulous. Okay. This is one, I don't know how many people know this movie, but I've seen it, and I find it a fascinating flick because I am from a very religious Catholic family. Audrey Hepburn in The Nun Story.
Yeah, now this is one of the few examples where it's a performance that was nominated for an Oscar. And the reason I included it is that, you know, since Audrey Hepburn has died, you know, she has become a true icon. That word is thrown around so carelessly, but right. She really is a screen icon, a fashion icon. She is someone that there has never been anyone like her before or since. But a reason I wanted to include this is that so much of the legend of Audrey Hepburn is based on a few roles, sort of the princess of Roman Holiday,
Sabrina. And sort of
Holly Go Lightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's, or even My Fair Lady with the Cecil Beaton gowns. It was so much about the glamour and the right. fashion and all mm-hmm. that. And I thought people forget what a terrific actress she was. And there's no better example than to go to a movie in which the fashions meant absolutely nothing, because she's dressed in a nun's habit for almost the entire movie. So it's really just Audrey Hepburn's face and nothing else.
Right.
No accessorizing in this movie. And it's a great film. It really is a great film. That I wish more people knew. But I think the title gets in its way, where you see something like the nun. You think it's, oh, is that the singing nun? Or, right. you know, is that some saccharine kind of sentimentalized, right. you know, something
not
trying
even
to
close.
Jerk to you? It is a serious, probing drama into one person's mind about what am I going to do with my life? And it is extraordinarily made by Fred Zinnemann. It has an amazing supporting cast led by Peter Finch. And Audrey Hepburn is truly magnificent in where she takes this role. And like, I keep going back to the word depth, because it does separate sort of, you know, the amateurs from the pros.
Right.
And when you can get to make, when you're able to make an audience feel this is a three-dimensional, living, breathing human being, and that's what she does in this role, then you have done your work. I mean, you are a master at the art of screen acting, because she makes you believe every sort of flicker of her eye
yes.
Tells you something about this woman. And she's just extraordinary. So I want people to be reminded that as enchanting a creature as Audrey Hepburn is in something like Funny Face or Charade, you know, she's it's just this magical screen creature. She was, when stripped of all of that, she was an extraordinary actor.
She really was. And this, I think, like you said, she was nominated as well as
yeah.
she should be. It's a fascinating story, and don't be turned off by the nun story, because it has
yeah.
so many things you would, and she was great.
Yeah.
She was also great in The Children's Hour. You know, she was
yeah.
not,
yeah.
I liked her as an actress. She was just
yeah.
not as a
right.
little poopy-doo Sabrina or whatever.
Ooh.
I just
yeah.
enjoyed Audrey as
yeah.
an actress. Okay, I think we can do one more.
Okay.
So why don't we do this one, my friend? Because I find this one, this movie, I don't think is very well known either. Olivia de Havilland in Light in the Piazza.
Yes, I'm glad. Good one. I mean, well, they're all good ones, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, after The Heiress, when she got her second Oscar and then she ends up moving to France, we don't really think too much of Olivia de Havilland's movie career after the 30s and 40s.
Right.
I mean, yes, we all enjoy Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, and she's very good in that. But I mean, we don't really think of her having, you know, meaty roles and A productions. And this is a beautiful role in a beautifully done Technicolor MGM movie shot on location in Italy about a mother and daughter, and it's about a marriage. And it's such an interesting movie. I don't believe it caused much of a stir back in 1962. But when you look at it now and you think, wow, Olivia de Havilland, she is so good. When she gets a really good role, and there weren't that many for her at this point in time, and she just savored it. And I just love it. There's a warmth in this, a love as a mother, as I said, as a wife in a marriage that may be on shaky ground, and she has a very slight flirtation with Rosanna Brazzi, but it's got so much, and it doesn't. It's actually now a little more well known because there was the musical on Broadway.
I didn't know that. When was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, about a dozen years ago, which is lovely. I actually prefer the story in the movie version than to what they did to the story in the show, but it has a gorgeous score. So that gave the title more renown. But see it, it's got George Hamilton is in it.
He was
never
good.
Been better.
Oh,
Yvette Mimieux, never been better.
Great.
And it's an odd little story. And I don't want to say too much. It's good for people to discover what's going on for themselves. But it's very unusual, and it's very, I guess, tastefully done would be a way to say it, although that sounds like maybe you don't want to see it. But it's really they make such good choices moment to moment, and it's really again held together by the central performance, and in this case that's Olivia de Havilland,
which was wonderful. And it is a unique story. It's not something you would see every day. I can't recommend this movie highly enough. And they like he said, George Hamilton, you might scoff, Mr. Tan Man, he was great.
Yeah.
Yvette Mimieux, I thought she did a wonderful job. And like you said, heart and soul was Olivia. She was amazing. And I love this movie. And you guys should check it out. So, hey, we got to 55 minutes. So why don't we, you know, I know you've got to go, but we did. We're not going to make you tired out. But I want to tell everybody that I love John. John, you're fabulous.
I and love you too, Grace.
I want John, of course, again and again. So I do recommend his books. It's Christmas time, and I'm saying this just as a person. 10 movies at a time. This is the one we did, the first one that we only got to 1940. 10 movies at a time, a 350-film journey through Hollywood and America, 1930 and 1970, and John does an amazing job. He talks about what's going on in our history of America along with the films that are playing at the time, which is a really great book. And this one that we talked about today is 100 Great Scream Performances You Should Remember, but probably don't. And it is a really good book, and he has made amazing choices. I picked out a few that I knew, and there are others that I didn't choose because I figured, you know, whatever, you can look through them. But these are the ones that I thought would be more interesting to people. But it was amazing. And thank you, John, because you're a great guest. You know your stuff, and I love your books.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Thank you so much, Grace. Well, happy holidays to you. Happy New Year. I can't believe we're saying that already.
No, and here I am. I look like a pirate. I'm here like Jeremy Timbers. But I'm doing okay. Now, let's hope for sight for 2019.
Yes.
But thank you so much, John. You're fabulous. Look for his books, John DeLeo. And go to Amazon. You can find them. Great stuff. Great gifts for people who love classic movies. I mean, he really knows his stuff. He studies. And it's good stuff. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks, guys, for listening. And we'll be hearing from you soon. And thank you, John. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Grace.
Bye.
Bye.
Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who were dear to us will be near to us once more. Someday soon. Until